Hi, this is Fabi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like
somebody lied to her several times and told her she was fly, hot, and sexy, and beautiful. And she's nothing like that. She's nothing of the sort.
Oh my God, a classic.
Hello, hello, hello.
Que show, que show, que show.
What it do, Babelito?
¿Cómo estás, mujeres?
I am just feeling
yourself.
Funky and fresh.
Yes.
You know, I'm just here living my truth, organizing my art studio because I'm doing a lot of traveling.
I can see that. I've been around the studio since I came back from Albuquerque for a couple of weeks, and that's all you've been doing.
I know, because I have to move out of here soon. I'm so sad.
That's going
to
be
fun. So I'm trying to slowly organize, so it's going to be easier for me to move out of this beautiful place.
That's smart. Every time we move, you know all the shit that we have in our house. It's like a cabinet of curiosities.
It's too much.
So it takes us like 3 months to pack. So packing a couple of boxes a day is the smart way to go.
Yeah, and it gets to the point where I buy the same shit over and over again because I can't find the things I need. So, like, I'm looking through all my paper right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I have every
color.
I was like, why? I have, like, all these packets of color that I bought because I was like, oh, I ran out of purple. I got to go buy purple. I just found, like, 30 packets of purple that were, like, hiding.
Oh, in the heck.
I know. I know. Lessons.
Yes.
Lessons.
So you're going to take every single piece that you have right here? Or, oh, yeah, because you recycle some of the stuff, right?
I reuse, yeah. Yes. Recycle is a weird word because then people think I'm like all about the environment and bullshit like that. I don't really
Which
care.
Which you should be. You should
Who
be.
Who cares? Why?
You have done all these pieces where you recycle old work. You did a whole workshop based on that.
I recycle the work not because like I'm environmentally conscious. I recycle because I'm poor. And like that's the materials I have, so I'm just gonna keep using them.
Just keep that to yourself. Just say that you do
no,
it.
No, no, because then it's like people romanticize that shit all the time. They're like, "Oh, he recycles everything." Like, okay, but it's also a statement on like being an immigrant and being like a Latino, Chicano, whatever you want to call me. Like, we just reuse the same shit over and over.
I was gonna say, it's also a statement of having the meaning and the power of one object be transferred to another one. And that's something that Latino cultures have been doing for thousands
True.
Of years. So.
Like when I go to your mom's house and she has the Yogurtland spoons in the salsa. I was like, damn, that's a nice touch.
My mission for this past trip to Puebla was to find wooden spoons for my mother for her salsa because she's so particular. If you go to her drawer, she's like, estas cucharas son para comer.
But she found the
y estas
perfect
son
size.
Para la salsa.
Right. The salsa ones are like the yogurt land, like the pinkberry spoons, you know?
Yes.
Which, if you think about it, they're the same size as the salsa ones.
You know, when I went to La Judy's house, when I first moved with her, that was the first thing I noticed.
What?
I'm like, oh, you have all these salsa spoons. She's like, no, those are for the kids.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What did you have for lunch today, Babelito?
I had a Peruvian sandwich with chicken and I don't know what else. It was amazing.
With chicken and I don't know what else.
I was so hungry because I hadn't eaten in 20 hours. I counted them.
I know. You're like, I got to go eat. I'm like, bitch, I'm poor.
But
I had a free sandwich from the restaurant because I've been so many times. I was like, let's go.
¿Tú qué pediste?
I had a lamb burger. So it was a burger with lamb.
La gentrificación.
Oh, my God.
It's real.
Oh, wonderful lamb burger with a little bit of mint on it. It was beautiful.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Gamey.
Gamey. That was really good. Those sandwiches are the bomb.
I know, but they're not paying us, so we're not going to say the name of the restaurant.
No, no.
But if you're in downtown Las Vegas, you know exactly where we went.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So good. So good.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about Miami and what we're about to listen to?
Oh, So like I mentioned in one of our last episodes, I had a little bit of a rough time in Miami. Because, you know, I don't like the sun and the ocean and...
Arena y sol.
That, I don't like that.
El mar azul.
And animals. No, I like some animals. But I ended up finding people that were really cool in the end, you know, in Miami. And one of the people was Maria Elena Ortiz from the PAM, the Perez Art Museum in Miami.
What is that? Like, is it a contemporary art museum?
Or? It's like their main art museum. Yeah, contemporary art. I mean, they have a collection, but most of the art that I saw there was new. So, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, they had a video installation with Selma Hayek playing like a Middle Eastern character.
Dios
mío. I know. Talk about shapeshifter. And I told the curator, I didn't know it was the curator. Shout out to Jennifer. I was like, what, you guys couldn't get... I said, you guys couldn't get Shakira to play the role? At least she's Colombian. At least she's actually Lebanese.
No, so it's...
I know, so Selma Hayek. Oh my God, Selma Hayek is everything. She's Mexican, she's Middle Eastern, she's...
European. Oh my God,
she's white, she's black, Latina. She can be whatever she wants.
And now she's working class in this new movie.
Oh my God, we have to go see it.
We have to go see it. Okay. Yeah. A lot of people like it, so... This is the last benefit of the doubt I'm going to give her, but we'll see what happens.
I love her. You know, she was in Fools Rush In, one of my favorite movies.
She helped me stay in the closet in my teen years. Remember, we talked about that when Ramiro... Of her.
Oh, my God.
Posters.
Waque chula.
I know.
Okay, anyways, so we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with a conversation that I had with Maria Elena Ortiz. This week's episode has been brought to you by BlueApron.com. Hey, Bavelito, do you want to talk about your Blue Apron experience?
Let me tell you what happened this past week.
Dish, girl.
I was fresh. I was fresh from Albuquerque.
Tell
and
me.
I arrived to my house. Uh-huh. I opened the fridge. Y no había ni madre en el refrigerador.
That's the worst
except
feeling.
For the ingredients for a Blue Apron meal. Because I ordered them in advance.
Yes.
Because I know my dude.
Okay.
So what I did, I said, okay, let's do this together. And we never cooked together. So he came to the kitchen. In 15 minutes, we put this amazing meal together.
Oh, puerco.
We had vegetables. I mean, we had this dish with vegetables and currants in it. I would never thought to do that. And it was pretty amazing.
What is a currant?
A currant is like a pasita.
Oh, like a little raisin?
Pasa.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I've eaten that. And
only through Blue Apron you're going to find these types of ingredients.
I know. And check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/Latinos. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/Latinos. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Oye, Fabi.
What's happening?
Have I tell you about chatbooks?
No.
You know what it is?
Chatbooks?
Chatbooks.
Chatbooks, like chat, like wara wara la cuchara?
Like wara chara chara la cuchara.
What's chatbooks?
Chatbooks is one of the coolest apps that has come out. Chatbooks, basically what you do is that you link your app to your Instagram, your Facebook, or your camera roll. Uh-huh. And every 60 pictures, it puts together a book for you and it's shipped to you for free anywhere in the U.S.
Shipped for free?
Yes. So have to do is just take pictures. Let's say that you're a mom and you have all those kids and you don't have time to put together those complicated books, you know, with other companies. Like my sister, she puts together this calendar every year, but a girl...
What?
It takes her like 3 months, so we get our calendars by like March or April because you have to do all this very complicated designs.
Okay, so like... I download the app.
That's right.
I pay for the service.
That's right.
And then I get every 60 photos, a book shipped for free to my house.
Yes.
Of my Instagram or my Facebook or my camera roll.
Correct. So all you have to do is just take pictures como loca. And then again, every 60 pictures, they all come together in this beautifully designed book that you don't have to do anything.
My mom is going to love this. Yes. My mom can't turn on a computer, but I stuck on el WhatsApp, so like she knows how to use her phone. And this is great.
And the best part is that it includes captions, dates, and locations, so you don't have to do absolutely anything. All you have to do is just take pictures, and you're going to start making your collection. Get your first serious book free with promo code LUNCH. Again, get your first serious book free with promo code LUNCH. And remember, it must say serious book. And all you have to do is go to chatbooks.com or simply go to the App Store and download
serious?
Chatbooks. Yes.
Like serio?
Like serie.
Oh, series.
Series, así es.
Oh, okay.
Again, get your first serious book free with promo code LUNCH.
All right.
Yay.
I was like,
I know her, Maria Elena, because I knew that you worked here at the PAM. So first question, though, Maria Elena, what do you do? What do you go by?
Well, you know, if possible, I go with Maria Elena. You know, it's but I'll make the long story short. When I first moved to the U.S., I was born and raised in Puerto Rico. I suddenly became Maria, and I hated it. I mean, in general, I hated my name to begin with when I was in Puerto Rico. It's everybody's name Maria. Like, there was like five Marias in my freaking class, and I was one of many. So the middle name becomes very important.
Yeah.
Eventually, I ended up liking it a little bit more because, you know, Maria is the virgin and Elena is like Ellen of Troy, which is like this beautiful like woman that was with two men. So I kind of like that contradiction. Mm. And then after I was here in the U.S. for a while, I went to work in Mexico City, and suddenly there I was able to be Maria Elena again because people were like, oh, you know, they can't pronounce my name.
Yeah.
And I loved it because that's my preference. And then when I moved back here to the States to work here in Miami, people are more flexible with the language. So there's some people that can say my name the way it is, and others who just want to say it correctly because they want to be very PC about it, which I don't really care. Like, I really don't care. Yeah. Like, I actually, you know, like being here, I've been thinking, should I just go back to Maria sometimes? Because I don't want to feel your pain when you're trying to say my name, because yeah. I know how that feels. There's Chinese names, there's many other English names that I have a hard time, English words that I have a hard time saying. So yeah. I think it's, so anyway.
Well, even coming to the Perez, right?
Yes.
Like, I just like saying Pam because there's not, yes. I don't have to think about it like Perez, but everybody's like, oh, you're going to the Perez, right?
Yes.
So that's something funny that I've noticed here is like the pronunciation of words, like no matter where you go, I mean, that's what happens with the Spanish language. And yeah, people being very extra and trying to overpronounce things, right?
Yes.
Like, people give me shit all the time because my work is in a piñata style. But depending on where I am, I'll say piñata because it's just, right? It's just faster.
Yeah.
And like my brain is in English, so I just say piñata, right? And then, like, for example, I had a conversation with somebody here in Miami, and I said piñata, even though I was speaking in English.
Yeah.
And they just kept repeating the word, like, piñata, piñata. I love the sound of that. And I was like, really? Oh, my God. Like, this is why I do it. This is why I don't say piñata sometimes, because I don't want...
Yes.
I don't want them to...
The exoticism.
To exoticize it.
Well, and I think that people forget that language is fluid. Like, language is supposed to change, and it's supposed to evolutionize. I mean, I have been to Aruba a few times, and I get very surprised there with the Papiamento, which is, like, this merging of, like, four different languages, like Spanish, Dutch, English, and some even native language. And I think that those people are beyond, actually... our language capabilities.
Yeah, and when we did our lecture, Jose Diaz from the Warhol Museum was there, and he asked us a really interesting question about the word Latinx, and you're talking about the evolution of language. That word right now is I think, a key word to kind of talk about.
Definitely.
What Latinx is and what that means.
Definitely. I mean, I think a lot of people talk about Latinx in relation to gender and like trying to, you know, kind of go beyond this feminine and masculine gender binary. I'm not that interested in that because I think that's just one part of another bigger thing. I think that the beauty about Latinx and taking away the gender is it actually approximates the term to a U.S. and English experience. Suddenly, there's no gender. There's not Latino, which is actually very much a Spanish word that disregards the female aspect of it. But you take another gender, suddenly it becomes an English word in a sense,
right?
Which speaks to what it means to be here in the United States as a person of Latin descent or Latin background or whatever you want to, however you feel.
Yeah. I know you're from Puerto Rico. You've lived in Mexico City, San Francisco. You went to school in Boston.
Yeah, in Houston, Texas, as well.
Houston, Texas, Mexico.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now you're in Miami, which is, I mean, the Latinos here are like nowhere else in the world. That's what I've realized. I kind of just want to know a little bit about you and like how you identify. Or did you have to change maybe your what you identified as in different spaces in different cities?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I don't know if I can answer it. I'm just gonna spit out, and maybe I don't know. Somebody will probably have an opinion.
they always do.
Yeah, and they can find me on Instagram or on Facebook, Marilene Ortiz at Marilene, whatever. So I grew up in Puerto Rico, and I knew that I was black when I grew up there because, you know, in Latin America and our countries, I was going to say, there's like this nationalist construct of we are of many things, but there's also a pigmentocracy. And what I mean by that is a hierarchy of color that was very much established by the colonial powers. You can just go Google Casta paintings and you're going to know what I'm talking about. And the pigmentocracy did not only dealt with skin tone, but also facial features, hair. Like I, you know, at an age 9, my mom took me to the hair salon to get like my hair straightened. So I grew up knowing that I was black. And I mean, I'm not going to go in this spill, but like I had incidents, you know, in Puerto Rico that reaffirmed that experience.
Yeah.
And even though people constantly say, oh, Puerto Ricans were black, the Taino and Spanish. So I knew that. And I also, growing up in Puerto Rico, knew that I had a Latin heritage. Well, I was maybe Latin American because we speak Spanish, because we got a lot of Spanish culture there. A lot of the way I see the world is also determined by the language that I speak, which my mother language is Spanish. So I knew that. Now, once I actually left the island, and of course I knew I was from the Caribbean. So, you know, those were kind of the three things. And a woman. That was also, I think that after black, probably woman was the other one that came second. And mainly is because I was, you know, I grew up in a family of women, and my mom was actually like the breadwinner. So I knew what it meant, that struggle of my, and the struggle of us, you know, when we were growing up, reggaeton was happening. Which at that time was called something else called underground, and just fighting to be able to go to a reggaeton concert as a woman. So I knew that those two were the factors. Then when I left when I left for the first time for the U.S., suddenly I noticed that for a lot of Latin Americans, and what I mean by Latin Americans are people that are actually born and raised in Mexico, Argentina, even Dominican Republic, they didn't see Puerto Ricans as Latins. They saw them as Americans. They saw us as, you know, people that spoke really bad English, really bad Spanish. And there's actually some truth to that. And it's not that it's bad Spanish. It's that even though you speak a lot of Spanish, you speak Spanish in the island, the language has been very anglicized. So the sentence construction, people they don't realize it, but they actually, you also hear a lot of sentences that start with verb, the same way you do it in English. So the language, because of the English influence, have changed. So, but it was the first time that I felt like, oh, this is a Latin person telling me that I'm not Latin, I'm actually American. You know, I didn't care that much about that because I still like Soda Stereo and I still knew who I was. What was interesting, and that was actually an easier thing to negotiate because all Latin Americans are very different. So if you're going to start throwing drugs at me, I can easily start throwing drugs at, throw rocks at you.
Yeah.
You know? But I was also very captivated by who I was in the different parts of the United States. So when I was in Boston, New England, people, and I also had my hair straightened at that time. I was also actually very overweight. I was almost 300 pounds. People knew my phenotype more. They, like, you know, if I said I was Puerto Rican, they would know, okay, yeah, you could fit into that category. Although I would also get people telling me, oh, but you're not blonde. Like, you're not like J-Lo and Ricky Martin. And that was like, well, you know, no, I'm not actually, you know. And then when I was in, so people were not freaked out by my phenotype. Totally changed when I was in Texas, in San Francisco, and Mexico is another conversation. But certainly in San Francisco and in Mexico, and in Texas, which I guess is, was once Mexico. And I was telling you earlier that at that time I used to have a boyfriend that was, my ex-boyfriend was Mexican-American, and we would walk into restaurants, and the server would speak to him in Spanish, and he wouldn't speak any Spanish because he grew up, he was Chicano. He was raised to denounce his language. And then I would start speaking in Spanish, and they would like go, they would like, what, you speak, you know, like curly hair black woman, you speak Spanish, like where are you from? And I would get it from Latins, and I would also get it from blacks, African Americans. Not, you know, I think white people are like in a different category, but it's more the minorities, how I relate to the other minorities. That's what I found more interesting. And I would get from, like, I remember being in the dorms and African-American friend telling me, oh, there's black people in Puerto Rico? And I was like, yeah, I mean, don't you know that the Caribbean was, like, the safe market? And that was also shocking because you start seeing also how history is being taught and who's included in that history and who isn't. And then I would also get from, because technically in Puerto Rico, I'm a mulatto, which means that my dad is white and my mom is black. And although I am black, you know, you look at me, you might not to that conclusion.
I don't see color.
Yeah. But I remember being in a bus and somebody, and also another African-American person asking me about my hair. What's up with your hair? Your hair looks kind of weird. Like, are you mixed? And that's the first time, and those, especially living in the South and in California, the first time I also experienced what it's been to be in the South of the United States, which I love the South, I have to say. But, and also the contrast between the pigmentocracy, in which in the pigmentocracy you can look white and you're white, versus in the U.S., which is like the one drop rule. If you have one drop, you are one or the other, you know? And so that was intriguing. And Mexico is a very more complex situation because there, you know, you have a lot of indigenous groups. They're all very diverse, some of which don't even speak Spanish. And you have this really European class that controls everything, or that they're in power. So the level of oppression is, it's more complex because there's, you know, like my ancestors that were brought up on a boat, enslaved, and go into the Americas, and then they were enslaved in another home. There's people there that were enslaved in their own home. And then, you know, imagine if somebody just walks into your house and just tells you, I'm the chief now. And then on top of that, you have this crazy sibling, hyperactive teenager, also known as a U.S., kind of like having this imperialistic drive. So I'll leave that for another.
Another segment.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm very interested in that dynamic because I've had some conversations with Mexicans about Puerto Rico and vice versa, and the difference between how, let's say, Puerto Ricans treat Mexicans versus Americans, right? Because like we were talking about before.
Yeah, well, what do they say?
Like, they're more welcoming. Like when we go vacation there, for example, right? They're more welcoming to Mexicans than they are maybe white Americans or Mexican Americans. Well, have you heard of that?
Know, I think that if you go to Puerto Rico, like if you go to the island, people are very friendly. And they're very, especially, you know, now more than ever, you know, we're bankrupt, so we need money. So go there, please, take a vacation.
Visit Puerto Rico.
It's really nice. Yeah. American dollars, you know.
Right.
Great, great time. More exotic than Miami. Anyway, I mean, I do think that, you know, Puerto Rico is still a U.S. colony, so there's a weird or a tense relationship with the U.S. And I think that Mexico, in a way, you know, Mexico is a country of great culture. It's a really, you know, it's an old country. Like, Mexico City was founded, I don't know which year, you know, before, I don't know. So there's a lot of, it is a beautiful and rich country. So I think that there's also a lot of pride to see what, you know, and they became independent, like something that we never were able to do. So I think there's also a lot of pride and respect to those communities?
I don't know. I'm just going to say ignorant things and see what happens.
Okay.
So, but when I think Puerto Rican, I'm not far from the people that you were talking about. They're like, well, you're not J-Lo, right? When I think of Puerto Rican, I'm thinking of the Puerto Ricans that are in pop culture, right? Rosie Perez, right? I'm saying Perez.
Yes.
Rosie Perez, right? And J-Lo, right? And then, and those are people that are very representative of a very specific type of Puerto Rican from New York.
Yes.
Right? But I feel like Puerto Ricans from New York are, like I said, it's a whole nother island.
Yes.
Of people. It's a whole different, there's a lot of pride, but it's also its own thing over there.
Yeah.
Have you experienced that at all or speak?
Well, I definitely think that, you know, I definitely think that, there, which is why I think this Latinx term is important,
yeah.
Which means like, which it really defines which cultures you're in contact with and which are the cultures that are informing the construction of self and your position in the world. And I think that when I grew up on the island, I mean, it's a very different environment that growing up in New York. I didn't know what it was to have a modern art museum, you know, or a Studio Museum of Harlem or a Broadway or, you know, or the Met, you know, I didn't know that. We didn't have that. Like, we have a bunch of, we have great fortresses.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Taino Parks. We had a lot of great music, a lot of great food. But we also had a lot of political problems that were really pressing. Like, I don't know, like, for example, you know, if a hurricane comes, we knew that we were going to be out of water and out of electricity for at least 2 weeks. We knew what it was to be rain inside of a hospital. And Puerto Rico is not, you know, of the Caribbean, it's probably one of the best, quote unquote, depending how you define it, best infrastructurally. Like, it's not, you know, it's not Haiti or it's not as extreme, but certainly it wasn't like it was a different environment. And we also were very conscious of the colonial relation with the U.S. and politics and voting for statehood or not statehood or what it meant. I mean, when I first moved to the U.S., I had friends that stopped being my friend and then called me a petit Yankee. Like, I don't think that, I don't know, but I haven't come across a Puerto Rican that was born in New York or elsewhere that have had those same type of dynamics or what it means to, like, protect your Spanish, you know, and speaking Spanish and all that stuff that comes with the fact. And also growing up in an island, like, but there's, at least in New York, you can, even though Manhattan is an island, you can go elsewhere.
Yeah.
In Puerto Rico, you can't. Like, and you're constantly looking at the sea as your way out or as your protecting barrier. I think there's a difference, which is why, again, I think this Latinx term is important for us as a Latin community to start really becoming more aware of what it means to be in this country, in the U.S., and 'cause I think that that could help us become a real political force.
And another thing that's important, and I think that you play a really important role in, is being part of this art world that we're in. And very interesting art world, very, to me, very complicated, confusing world. What I love is the more museums I've been going to now, the more I start seeing more people of color, more Latinos, more Latinx curators,
yeah.
Right? Which is so important because it's so, not only is it great for visibility because curators like you obviously are looking at the world with a different lens, but it speaks also to what's happening with our population here in the United States. Latinos are going to be the majority minority,
yeah.
And we need to be represented not only in the government, but in cultural institutions.
Definitely.
So I want to kind of talk to you about maybe your journey becoming a curator and being here in Miami. Like, how did that happen?
Yes. And I also wanted to add to your sentence.
Sure.
That population that's going to be the majority is all going to be like 18 or under 25. And that's a big deal because there's our young people that need leaders and that cannot be oppressed or be let oppress. You know, I grew up not knowing what a curator was. In Puerto Rico, you can only be a lawyer, a pastor, a drug dealer, or a doctor. Those are like your four choices.
Those
are your options. Some are more lucrative than others. And some have actually downgraded. I think that lawyer is not as as cool as it is to be a drug dealer or a reggaeton star. So I really did not think that I could be that there. And I would always hang out with artists, and I would always have artist friends. But I knew that I didn't want to become neither a doctor, a pastor, or a drug dealer. So I actually decided to study anthropology after my mom told me, because I first told her I wanted to do art history, and she's like, oh, you're going to die of hunger. And now looking back at it, she was right. Like, if I studied art, like, I don't have a job in Puerto Rico, you know what I mean? Like, and there's a reason for that. But I started college in the U.S., and I decided to do anthropology because I thought that, you know, it sounded, like, serious enough that they wouldn't harass me as much as what I was doing. But then it also gave me the opportunity to think about culture, which I was really interested in. And I also minored in art history because I wanted to do art history, and my mom, you know. So that was, like, my negotiating skills mm-hmm. there. And then I started at BU, and I couldn't finish, and I had to transfer. Then I transferred to the University of Houston. And at the University of Houston, I had a professor, Dr. Coombs.
Shout out.
Yes, Dr. Coombs in Houston. That I was once in his class, in his art history class. And he told me, you know, I think that you should work in a museum. And there's a fellowship at the MFH in Houston. And if you apply, I will support you. And I really, and that's the first time that I thought, wow, there could be like another possibility for me besides doing that would let me still hang out with my friends. And I didn't apply to the fellowship, but I started looking into what he wanted, what he was saying. Mm. And that's when I discovered the curator role. And then I was very fortunate because in Houston at that time, it was like 2005, 2006, and Franklin Sermons, who's actually now my director here at PAM, or the Perez, or El Perez.
El Perez.
he was actually the creator of contemporary art at Menil Collection, and he's an African-American, so that was nice to see as another Black person. And then in Houston, the MFA Houston, there was this other Puerto Rican curator. Her name is Mari Carmen Ramirez, who she's like a powerhouse. And I had kind of like the two references that kind of become who I am, you know, a Latin person, a Black person in front of me doing their job. And I think that really certainly inspired me to do it. And I thought I could totally do it. And I knew that I could do it because at this point, remember I told you earlier that I was 300 pounds in whatever. At this point, I already lost 100 pounds. And that's really hard.
Yeah.
So I thought, like, well, let me do this. And my mom, you know, she didn't stop me, which I really appreciate. Like, she didn't know what I did for a long time. She didn't know. Like, when I was in Mexico, like, I don't think she knew what the hell I was doing. I think after when she visited this museum, she's like, oh, it's a museum, okay, you know, like,
yeah.
And it's a nice building. But she never said to me, don't do it. Like, she just said, you know, I'm only going to support you until this age, you know, that's it. Like,
yeah.
And I think that's all I needed to know, that whatever I did, I need to find, you know, figure it out.
So do you think your mom understands what you do now and, like, supports it, or does she still?
I think she definitely supports it,
okay.
110%. I don't know if she knows exactly that well what I do or what my days are like. She knows that I, you know, I travel a lot and that I've been able to, I don't know, a few, like last year I did a show in Lenny Kravitz game. So I
showed my, yeah.
And then also like the year before, one of my favorite bands ever in the world, Spanish band named Mecano.
Oh.
I met the band, one of the band members, Jose Maria Cano, who's also an artist. And I was able to visit the studio. And, you know, so she kind of sees some of, like, the glitz and the glam, I guess. And my younger sister, she doesn't even think I work. Like, she tells me, oh, you're just out traveling all the time. Like, que vidita, you know? Like, what? But whatever, you know. I, you know, going back to also how I'm here, I did a lot of internships, which means I work for free, which I don't. Mm-hmm. I recommend it, but I don't recommend it. Like, you could do it to a certain point, there's a moment, and you know that moment when you need to get paid. And if you're not getting paid, move on and get that paid thing going.
Yeah.
I did apply to diversity. I did a diversity internship with Art Table. You know, and I support those type of programs, you know, like the diversity fellowship and stuff like that, because it gets your foot in the door.
Yeah.
And museums are really hard to get into. Like, right. They're really, really hard. Like, it's not a lot of job out there. There's a lot of competition, and there's not a clear, I mean, I think for artists it's even harder because it's not a clear path, but there's a reason why there's a lot of families of people that are in the arts together, you know, curators yeah. that are sisters or brothers of someone else, or curators that are sons of someone else or whatever, you know, because it's not an easy place to get into.
So let's get into that a little bit. Let's break it down. Like, what, I feel like a lot of our listeners know about the art world a little bit because Babelito and I are kind of in it. I'm saying kind of. Babelito's an art
historian. We're talking here.
Yeah, so. He's an art historian, and I'm faking it till I make it. So,
like all of us, I think most of us.
Uh-huh. But let's break it down. Like, what do you do day to day, and then on a larger scale, what is your role at this museum or at any job that you've had as a curator? What does it mean to be a curator?
I mean, I think in the simplest form, a curator is a cultural producer. We produce culture, we produce cultural moments. We're ambassadors of culture in its simplest form. And to understand also the rise of the curator, just look at the rise of the tourist industry in our time. Like, ultimately, we serve our communities, but we also serve people that are traveling to Miami to see what the city is and see who we are. My day-to-day varies. Like, sometimes, like a day like today, I just opened a show 2 weeks ago, so that was nice. I took a vacation.
Much deserved.
Yes. But the day of the opening, for example, I had to, like, finish the finishing touches, do a tour, be at the opening event, mingle with people, not get drunk, be on my, you know, then go to a dinner with sponsors, people that have been supporting the show. And of course, you know, do my job. Now I'm working on other shows, so I'm more on the research part of things. So I'm like checking timelines to confirm writers for a book, for a catalog that I'm working on, working with the artist directly to determine the list of works that are going to be in the exhibition, also doing studio visits, going to galleries. So my job varies from a lot of writing and research to then public aspects, like giving talks, giving tours, just what I, you know, being in the museum, I walk around and people saying hi to people, making sure that they're enjoying their time here, helping them out, making sure they make sense of what's happening. Also dealing with sponsors and trying to secure more supporters for the museum and being the PR person. For that, I also travel a lot, it sounds really good, and I like it. I love traveling, but it's also taxing on the body and taxing on your personal life because you're constantly kind of in and out. So it's like a producer of sorts and also, you know.
Yeah, yeah, definitely a producer. I mean, you have to wear so many hats and have so many skills to make an art show happen, right, as a curator, from actually doing the administrative work.
Yeah. And switching the gears, like,
and
that's and that to me is actually one of the hardest thing, like to switch gear from like production to more analytical. That's hard.
And I think one of the roles that I find that's very important for curators is the interpretation of the work. So, you know, you giving tours, but also down to the wall text, right? How people are going to consume the work that maybe don't understand. That need a little help, right? Understanding what they're seeing. I think that's important a lot of the times.
Yeah, it is. But sometimes I also wrestle with that. Yeah. Like, there was a time that I used to be very pro labels. Now I'm not sure. Like, I think art, you know, can be very authoritarian to tell somebody this is what this is. So that's also a question of style and what you think your curatorial practice should be about.
Yeah, because I'm seeing a lot now with shows that I see, maybe they don't describe the work exactly, but will give you just a little background on the artist. Like, this is so-and-so, they're from here, and they were thinking about this when they were making the work. Just to give you a little more context, I think that helps a lot.
Well, you know, I also I need to highlight that I also work in a big museum,
yeah,
which is like, you know, the museum for Miami, or for the city of Miami. So we are very aware that we get large publics, and interpretation and labels become very useful because we're actually serving a big group of people. In terms of, to me, the best labels actually just talk about the object and not things that you cannot see. Mm. And something that we do here with this question about background or context or nationality is that we don't actually put nationality on labels. We just put where they were born and when they lived, because, you know, how do we know how to X and Y and C thing, which nation they are, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we're trying to figure that out right now for, like, Latinos and stuff, and we don't even know, you know?
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, we were talking about so... Full disclosure, we had lunch before this because we wanted to truly be Latinos Who Lunch.
Yes.
And we were talking about how important it is to identify people the way that they want to be identified. Because a lot of the times, and that ties into your role as a curator, right? You are looking at things way different than, let's say, you know, a show that I've been curated into by white curators, right? They're looking at different things. Let them identify themselves.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. And something that I'm also interested in that you touched on that might be boring, but whatever, let's get into it, is your role as a curator dealing with sponsorship to museums. Because I know that there's a very specific line that curators have to toe a lot of the times, because you do need to get supporters to fund these organizations. And so I feel like a lot of the times... A lot of museums play it safe when it comes to curation because they don't want to upset anybody or ruffle any feathers when it comes to funding. And I want to know, like, have you had any experiences like that over the years working for any institution?
You know, luckily, I think I haven't. And I'm saying I think because I don't remember anything. I did have... In the show that we have right now, there is a work that I was worried about because it has a picture of El Che and Fidel in it. And we're in Miami, and those are very contested figures. Mm. Luckily, nothing happened with it. I think, but I do want to say something about what you said about museums playing it safe, or this question about sponsorship. I think that, you know, museums are nonprofits. And which means that as a business model, we work out of revenue. Basically, if somebody thinks that we are cool, or we're cool enough that people are coming here, they're gonna want to give us money to support that because they want to be affiliated with us. Now, more and more museums, you know, the government funding doesn't really exist, especially here in the U.S. You know, there's limited. And actually, PAM is a museum that gets a lot of support from the government. But now I'm talking more on a national. On a national level. So museums, their sources for looking for funding have diminished a lot, or have gone down significantly. It's also because, you know, now there's a trend of people actually owning their own museums and doing their own collections.
Yeah.
So I think that it's also more complex than supporters and funding. I think that one, to really address that question, one really needs to look at how philanthropy has changed in this country in the last 20, 30 years, because that really, and there was an article recently about how I think 5 galleries in the world have the most shows and whatnot. I think Leeson was one of them, and Gagosian and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because some of those galleries are supporting exhibitions, and museums have a hard time at times getting support because of the way that fundraising and the philanthropic culture has changed in the U.S. in the last 20, 30 years.
Yeah, so people need to make sure they support their local museums. And I think that it's, you know, a lot of people think, I don't have enough money to like, be a donor at a museum. But what people don't realize is, like...
We take anything.
Anything.
We take a dollar.
Seriously, a nonprofit, yeah.
Yes, like, we take anything.
Yeah.
And the museum is for you, too.
Right.
It's really, you know, like, it should be a place that you feel comfortable. It should be a place that, you know, really you can explore what it means a citizen in your own city is about. Like, it's really for you.
Yeah. As a curator, do you have any specific goals with the work that you do in these spaces?
I think a lot about that, because more and more you also see, like, this very recognized curators that you may not even know what they worked on. You might not even know their shows, but they're on Instagram and they're on social media. I want to be the type of curator that I saw, that I first saw when I first knew that I could embark on this path. And what I mean is, like, when I mentioned Franklin and when I mentioned Maddie Garman, those figures were trying to do represent who they are and create a space for other people that are like them. And that's the type of person I want. That's the type of curator I want to be. Like, even this show that's up now, The Domino Show, is a show that might seem kind of simple. It's about the domino game, but it's about something that I grew up with really closely. And that a lot of the works that are there are quite intimate and actually quite political and strong, you know, which is why I've been interested in this whole Latinx concept. Because I think that, again, like, we need to figure out a way culturally to really have more agency, because culture is power.
Like you said, right? The youth, they're going to be really important. And I think that programming to kind of involve maybe the young Latinx community is important. But like you were saying, visibility, right? Like, visibility is so essential. The more Latinos in these positions as curators, the better. And it's really changing, I think, the art world and the landscape in the United States in a really big way. So thank you so much for the work you do. It's incredible.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's a team effort, too. Yeah. Just the same way that Professor Tracuz told me I can do this, there's other people that told me I can do this along the way.
Yeah.
So it's certainly like it's a team effort. And yeah. Are you Latinx?
I think so. Yes. I identify as Latino. And so Latinx, you know, we just recently had conversation about this on Tamarindo podcast, which is another, which is kind of like our sister podcast. And we were all like, I don't know, whatever. It's a new word. But now I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah. I'm Latinx. That's awesome.
And when you met me, did you thought I was Puerto Rican?
I didn't know what you were. I just knew... I just knew that when I was doing the talk and I saw you, like, there's just a recognition. Like, the way that you were looking at me, like, when I needed some reassurance and I was talking at my talk and I felt kind of desesperado, like, oh my God, I feel like I'm drowning. Like, people hate me. And then I know nobody hated me, but, like, that's just my own insecurity.
Of course.
But there was, like, two or three people in the audience, and you were one of them, and I would look at you, and you just kind of nod. I'd be like, all right, I'm good. I have somebody here. So I knew from your name, Maria Elena, that you were Latina, but I didn't know what kind of Latina you were. Okay. So what do you identify as?
I mean, like I said, I have a hard time, like... I mean, I don't know. Like, again, I think I'm Black, I'm a woman, I'm Latin, I'm Puerto Rican. I don't know. Is there a word for that? Like, is there a word for who I am? Like, I don't... what is that?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know.
You're all of those things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... And I'm cool with that.
Yeah, because I was talking about... Yeah, people are like, don't put a label on me. I don't have it... You know, I don't believe in that. Well, I believe in... I'm all of that. So I'm Latino, I'm Latinx, I'm Mexican, I'm Guatemalan, I'm Chicano, right? Like I said in the talk, as long as the check clears, I'm a Chicano, right? Like, and I was so afraid to identify as Chicano for so many years because there's this like pride, like Chicano, Chicanx pride, right? Like, like chingones, like we represent this culture. And if you don't fit in these categories... Like, you're not real, you know? So when people are like, oh, this is Justin. He's a Chicano artist from Las Vegas. I'd be like, oh, I'm not a Chicano. I'm half Guatemalan, actually, and I'm first generation, and I'm this, and I'm that, and I'm that. But now I've been curated into so many shows solely because people identify me as Chicano that I actually have embraced it. And but I still don't personally say I'm a Chicano because... I'm that's like ignoring so many different parts of me and of my identity.
And I feel you on that one. I feel you on that one 110%. Like I dabble a lot, especially with that question, the Latin and the Black. Like, because here in the U.S., you know, one of the beauties of this country is the African American community has really created a space for themselves, or at least they're, you know, they're actively fighting and united to do that. And I don't feel the Latin community is the same because there's a, you know, it's just a little, it's just different. So I always wonder, do I need to choose a group? And I mean, I don't wonder about it that I wonder about it, but at the same time, I don't want to. So that's why I'm like, oh, you know what? I don't want to. So that's actually what just happened. I was like, but no, I'm like, I cannot, because I'm many things and I'm okay with that. And I actually like, I like being able to, when I'm in like a gym class, switch to Spanish when I need to switch to Spanish, share with somebody, you know, when I just had a bad day because somebody was kind of rude to me for no particular reason. An officer was rude to me.
Yeah.
I feel really happy when I can share that to one of my African-American sister and tell them, you know, yeah. Oh my God, you know, they're confusing me with my colleague because we're both of color, you know? So I really enjoy the multiple connections that I can make with more people. And I think that's special. I'm pretty sure not a lot of people can do that or if they can, they're learning to just be more flexible with who they are. Because at the bottom of the line, we can all, even the most, I don't know, like somebody from Idaho, a woman from Idaho, let's say she's a Caucasian or white, I'm sure that we can talk to each other as women.
Yeah. So just for fun, let's talk about, I mean, you just took a week-long vacation, you know, decompress, recharge, rejuvenate. Rejuve, as we say. Yeah. And what do you do for fun? What do you have any hobbies or what do you like to watch on TV? Stuff like that.
Well, I've been trying to detox from the Real Housewives because I do think that they're like bad. It's just bad. Like when you think about it hard enough, it's like fake wealthy people that don't have a lot of money. They're just faking it. Like a lot of people out there actually, especially in Miami. And also, I don't like how, or what I've been disliking more and more is how, for example, in the Orange County, they're all white, or in the New York, they're all white. Like, I have a hard time believing that all there's no diversity in those cities. I have a hard time believing that. And then I also find it strange that just the idea of a woman too, like they're quote unquote housewives, but they're actually working and some of them are not even married, like, and they've been divorced and domestic violence. Like it's kind of like this very, I don't know, poor, it's just poor intellectual quality. But I watched it last night, you know, I watched half of it yesterday, but I did half because at one point I started thinking about the same things I'm thinking right now. I was like, I need to go to bed. But besides that, I actually, I started exercising a lot, and I really like it because it gives me endorphins.
Yeah.
So I do that a lot because that's why I can have a smile. and also because, again, it's something that I never thought I was able to do, like when I was...
Exercise.
Yeah.
Can we get into that a little bit?
Yeah, of course.
Let's talk about that because on Latinos Who Lunch, we create a safe space, and we've actually had a couple episodes about being overweight in America. Well, in the world, really. I mean, it's cross-cultural, right? And I've always been big, and it finally, maybe like a year or two ago, I kind of let it go and just said, you know what? Because as a big person, as an overweight person, you never really looked at, I think, as a whole person. Because you're always like supposed to be on this fitness journey. And then like a year or two ago, I was like, you know what? Fuck it. This is who I am. I'm going to try to be healthy.
That's awesome.
Even though it's hard here in Miami because the food is off the chain.
Yeah. It's hard in the U.S. in general. Like,
but,
just don't.
But it's part of loving yourself. And I realized that once I did that, I actually started losing weight because I wasn't worried about what I looked like and stress eating. And you know what I mean? So it was so ironic, right? But you mentioned it a couple times.
You were,
I mean, 300 pounds, that's a lot, right? And you lost over 100 pounds.
Yeah,
now.
I did about 10 years ago.
Wow.
I started losing weight because, I think I went on a diet when I was 20 because I was living in Boston, fresh out of the island. It was a winter. It was like my first winter ever. And I couldn't walk as fast as my friends, and I was freezing to death. I mean, I grew up in 90-degree weather, and the experience of not being able to move as fast and thinking, oh, my God, like, I'm 20 or 18 or 19, and I cannot, and I'm like, you know, it's hurting myself. And that's when, and I think that also my grandfather died at the same time. So it was, I kind of got a reality check with life, and, you know, so I went on a diet. And it's interesting, you know, like you're saying, it's the first diet I did, it wasn't that healthy, and I lost a lot of muscle. Mm. And I was eating probably very little calories. I ate muscle. And it wasn't that healthy, but I dropped a lot of pounds.
Yeah.
And from that on, from that 10 years, I've always been, you know, you go into this yo-yo moment of like, you eat, blah, 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 blah. I have had that experience too about, like, especially when I travel. When I travel sometimes, like, when I got married, actually, I did a honeymoon, went to Spain, we were drinking and eating all the time, and I lost weight. And it's like, I think that definitely when you relax and when you just don't think about those things, you know, it becomes, you become a better, or you improve, and I think that's with everything too. I do think though, and one of the reasons why I've also kind of committed to it is because at the time I was really criticized, like 10 years ago, like when I was 20, I was really I was really against capitalism and now neoliberalism. Like, I was really aware of that. And I started thinking about how the two richest countries in the world, the fattest countries in the world, and how, like, you're just overeating the same way you're acquiring all this wealth or buying a lot of stuff with credit cards. You're doing the same with food.
Yeah.
And I really became kind of, I saw myself complicit in that narrative. Nowadays, I'm also really worried about what they put on our food. Like all the hormones, you know, when you get diagnosed with cancer, one of the first thing they ask you is what's your diet. You know, I don't think that we're aware. I don't know, aware of the fact that what we eat,
yeah,
we are like, if we're moving or we're not moving, that's really affecting our health. And I used to get more depressed, but now that I started exercising, I haven't had a depressive thought since I started. I just became hooked. And I'm not skinny. Like, I'm not a skinny person. I'm just, like, trying to live, you know, a healthy way.
Yeah.
And on that note, I also want to, something I learned now, and this is like a, you know, 10, 13-year journey since I first lost the weight, is that it's also not about the weight. Like, it's not about the pound number. Because I've been exercising a lot in the last 2 years, and I haven't really dropped a pound. I've been earning more muscle. I think it's really about how you feel and how you can maneuver, you know, the fact that, oh, one day you might be somewhere you need to take a walk and you can do that walk. Like, it's, you know, the weight is also a number. And I think that some of us, like, I have a big ass, you know, and that's not, and a big thighs. Yeah. That's my body. That's not going to change. And I don't want it to change either. So that's also where I'm at right now with that subject. It's more about, like, how you feel and being, and trying to take care of yourself.
And what is your favorite exercise right now? Like, what are you hooked on?
Right now, I'm hooked up on interval training on the treadmill. That's actually really cool because you can change your inclines and you can change your speeds, and you feel it very different in your body. Like, and what I mean by that is, like, it's interesting. I don't know, for me, as somebody that was most of her, I mean, I'm 33, and I lost weight when I was 20. So most of my life till this day has been as overweight person.
Yeah.
For me to be able to do that, like, I like cardio. I like intensity training. And I think that's another thing when I say talk about, learn about your body. It's not about, like, joining a gym and becoming whatever. It's really finding out what you like to do. Do you like to walk? Do you like to, you know?
Yeah, like, I was always terrified of group classes at the gym because being self-conscious, mm-hmm, like, I'm not gonna go do Zumba, like, that's nuts.
Yeah.
And then I started doing it and I was like, I fucking love this.
Exactly.
Like, it's the first few times I was like, this is one of the most humiliating things that I've ever done in my life, and I love it. And then so now I haven't gone in a little while, but like Babelito, my co-host, and I would go to, called Mix Fit. It's like hip hop light classes.
Oh, wow.
Kind of stuff.
So you must be good at coordination because I took Zumba once and I never returned because I realized, oh my God, I can never be Beyonce. Because it was hard to, for me, even though I can salsa, it was hard to coordinate like legs and hands and.
Yeah, I'm not that great, but I just keep moving. And I just like the whole, like, group.
Exactly.
It's fun. Like, you're dancing, right?
Yes.
So that, and walking and hiking, I like doing that too. but yeah, it's, yeah, you just have to find your way of doing it, right?
And yeah.
Like what works for you.
Yeah.
Which is important.
Yeah. And yeah. What makes you healthy. And again, I don't think I stress this a lot because it's not really about what you weigh on the scale. Like you can be heavy in pounds and you can still be a healthy person and vice versa. But the fact, like where I was at 13 years ago, I was having high blood pressure. I couldn't, you know, I was freezing to death in the winter. I couldn't walk well. Like I wasn't healthy.
Yeah.
And you know, I gained some of that weight back. But I feel now like if for some reason something happens right now, we have to run away the building, I think that I would make it outside. And I know 13 years ago, I couldn't, yeah. You know?
When the zombies come,
yeah,
we're going to be okay, right?
Yes.
Well, I'm not. You're going to be...
No,
I'll take one for the team.
No, if you can Zumba, that's hard. Like, yeah. To be moving for an hour, yeah. Or whatever that time, it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not, and you cannot... it's not easy. But, when I was younger, my mom put us like in tennis classes, and I used to cry when they would make us run this thing.
Yeah,
you know, like my level of like not moving was, you know, was really, you know, extreme. Like I even got, and I know I'm getting very personal, but
yeah.
I, you know, sometimes when you're very overweight, you can get fungus because you cannot
yeah.
see. I had that. Like
wow.
I remember having that.
Yeah,
I never got diabetes, or I never got. Like a serious condition, but I wasn't healthy.
Yeah, did you watch a lot of television, or like what was your thing when you were little?
I watched a lot of television, and also we ate a lot of fast food. Like,
yeah.
I don't think our parents, you know, our parents are the generation that they were growing up. McDonald's was like the coolest thing ever. So and they didn't know like what was doing to their bodies or
yeah.
to our bodies. So a lot of us grew up like that. On top of that, you know, our lifestyle has become more and more sedentary.
Yeah.
So we don't walk anywhere. We don't do anything. So it was like a combination of bad habits. But sometimes I think about, I have to admit that like a few months ago, I started thinking, what was I eating? Because, you know, you also wonder, because I eat a lot. I mean, we just had lunch.
Yeah.
I ate, you know, I wasn't.
We had a salad and a pizza.
Yeah.
And the pizza was... There was greens on it, which
yes.
is like amazing for Miami because I feel like all I eat is fucking fritanga everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God, vegetables, thank God.
Yeah, but yeah. that's the thing, that once you start eating vegetables, you start wanting them in your body.
Yeah.
But that to say that, you know, I eat pizza and I eat, you know, I have a cookie every night. Like I don't really, you know, I don't starve myself.
Yeah.
Because I like to eat and I like food.
Okay, I know you have to go, but really
yeah.
quick.
You saw me.
Yeah, let's talk about just a really quick, like
yeah.
a restaurant or your favorite food here in Miami.
In Miami?
Because let me just tell you, like
yeah.
I had really wonderful moments at eating Haitian food.
Yeah.
Because I'd never had Haitian food
okay.
before. So I was like, I love this fucking food. It's so good. But then same with like going to Pinolandia and to Palacio de los Jugos.
Yeah.
Like just seeing all this amazing Cuban, Puerto Rican, Central American food that I'm not used to because everything's so Mexican
yeah.
in Las Vegas. That's my favorite part of the food here in Miami.
Okay, so I have to say that I'm a foodie.
Yeah.
So I tend to go to the restaurants that are like a little bit snobbish. And then I'm like,
okay.
Oh, really? And actually, you know, we do a lot of dinners at the museum. So through that, I get to taste a lot of food. So I haven't been to Palacio de los Jugos. But there's other restaurants that I would definitely recommend in Miami. I would recommend Yardbird. Like, they have really good fried chicken. Their brunch is great.
Okay.
Every time I've been there, I sometimes have to take a nap afterwards. Like, it's that type of place, but it's worth going.
Mm-hmm.
I also like, there's a restaurant called Sardinia. It's an Italian restaurant up in at the beach as well. I also like a Spanish restaurant that is here downtown, which is called Neo Kitchen. It's like tapas. It's actually, I like that.
Oh, yeah, I saw it.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think I like that place. Which else? Well, I also go a lot to La Sandwicherie. Like, if you ever are at the beach on 14th Street, there's a sandwich place that is, you know, you can just grab a sandwich and go to the beach and eat it there or wherever, which I like. Recently, I went to Upland on the beach, and that was also... I live on the beach, so some of my restaurants are
what's
there.
What's your favorite kind of food?
The one I cook at home.
Yes. What do you cook?
Anything. I'm actually pretty free flow. Recently, though, my husband and I, we thought that we invented this dish, but we really didn't because I started Googling it, and we didn't. Because he's vegetarian, and I end up cooking a lot of vegetarian food. And one time we had a pasta. We didn't have any sauce. We didn't have anything. We only had like 2 ripe avocados. So we boiled the pasta. We mashed avocados, made like a guacamole, but without sour cream. And then we mixed it on the pasta. And then I poached 2 eggs. And that was delicious. Mm. That was really delicious.
That's delicious.
Yeah.
Making it work.
But I do gotta go, though.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was so nice talking to you. Thanks Likewise. For taking the time out of your day.
No, anytime for you.
All right. Bye.
And we're back.
That was so amazing.
I know. She's great, isn't she?
She's amazing.
Oh, my gosh. Shout out, Maria Elena. I'll see you again when I'm in Miami in December, hopefully.
You know, after all these conversations and interviews that you've had with people in Florida, I really want to go. I really want to visit.
Don't do it. Just kidding.
Correle!
Corre por tu vida! Oh, my God. There used to be this kid in my high school. Uh-huh. I just reminded. Shout out to Tyler Lewis. He could speak Spanish. Uh-huh. He's one of these Mormon kids who's like super talented, you know? He could like play the piano and the trumpet and speak fluent Spanish. But he had that really awesome accent. So he used to sing this song with his guitar. He's like, hay un incendio bajo de mi cama. Corre, corre, corre por tu vida. I'll never forget it. Oh I'll never God. Forget it.
It's like those new Mexican singers, De Colores.
De Colores. I was like, who's Colores?
Shout out to all those white people that love to speak Spanish even though they have a very thick
accent.
You know
what? That's so awesome. Rude. Yes. We're making fun of them.
Yeah.
Shout out to Pastor Leach when I used to go to church. Hermanos y hermanas, estamos aquí todos juntos para alabar al Señor.
But see, like, besides the accent, it's perfect Spanish. So, yeah, I know,
shout out.
So you want to start with your recommendation?
Sure. Okay, I'm going to recommend a podcast that I am obsessed with. And I've talked about this podcast before, but now that it's a new beginning, it's a new iteration of the podcast.
It's like a phoenix.
Oh, rising from the ashes. A caterpillar.
A cicada.
Transforming into, I don't know. Anyway, so I mentioned the podcast For Colored Nerds for a long time.
Yes, we talk about how we've fashioned part of their format into our own.
They were one of the For Colored Nerds was one of the podcasts that really inspired Latinos Who Lunch. Anyways, they have a podcast now on Gimlet Media called The Nod.
I haven't listened to it.
And it's all about them being black and black culture and what they love about black culture, blackness, being black, black with a capital B.
Yes.
And I just listened to the episode that they put out about this Beyonce conspiracy theory. It is so good. Oh, I'm not going to say anything. Ah! But there's a reenactment part that had me rolling. It was so funny.
I'm going to die. I have to listen to it.
The Nod. Check them out.
So I'm going to do the same and recommend a podcast. And I think we talked about this podcast before. That's Top Rank. And they are these girls from New York. But one of the things about this podcast that is annoying, but at the same time is great, is that they only come with an episode every couple of months. Mm. But every episode, Favi, is on point.
Yeah.
It's so well researched. There's so much content. And this past episode that just came out a couple of weeks ago, it's on the war of drugs.
The war on drugs?
The war on drugs that wasn't. That is the title. And it really goes into this history of how the war on drugs have been boxed and shown in media, and it's always to target
people of color
or people of lower income.
You know, I read about that, how the Nixon administration, they weren't getting the vote from hippies or from black people, right?
Y órale.
So then they've what is the word, vilified them
mm-hmm.
by making marijuana illegal, right?
Correct.
Because who was using, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, well, this is an episode about that, but it is focusing on the new epidemia of like opiates, Percocets, damn, and all that stuff. So it's so well detailed, it's so well researched, and I cannot recommend it enough. So again, the podcast is top ranked. They have a couple of episodes, the Selena one, Te Mueres.
Oh my God.
So good.
That is such a good episode.
And we talked about this
before. I've listened to it like 3 times.
But because it only comes out a couple of times, I feel like I have to tell people all over again.
You know, I think that's why we've never done a Selena episode. I mean, we will someday, mm-hmm. but theirs is just so good.
And that's why we haven't
done... We can't top it.
And we
top rank.
Also, Café Tacuba, because I have so much to say, and we have so much to say that we have to, like, you know...
We have to research
really
it.
Well research yeah. it, yeah. So.
Yeah.
Pinches flojos.
I know. We need to get our put our lives together. All right, guys. And as you know, you can visit our website, latinoswholunch.com. Check out all our episodes there. And if you want to send us some listener letters, we would love that too. If you have any questions, email us at latinoswholunch@gmail.com. We're putting a listener letter episode together right now, so it's not too late to send them in. And as always, it's so important that you guys rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Go on there, rate us 5 stars.
5 stars only.
Because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are. And visibility is...
Esencial.
That's right. So, you know, go on there, rate us 5 stars. If you have time, write a little review. That always helps you guys. We're on Spotify, we're on Stitcher, we're on Audio Boom, we're on Google Play. We are all
donde
over the place.
Les ocurra.
Aleluya. Amen. Amen. I'm Bobby Fav.
And this is Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao.